Man, if there is in your minds a reasonable uncertainty regarding the truth of the charge made here, you must find the defendant not guilty. This is a duty you are bound to by law. No matter how strongly you feel yourselves compelled to act in any other manner, you can convict only if you are certain it is correct to do so beyond a reasonable doubt. Second, said the judge, you must keep in mind the specificity of the charge and address that charge exclusively. You have only to determine one thing here, whether or not the defendant is guilty of murder in the first degree, and nothing else. If you determine that he is guilty of something else, of hatred, of assault, of manslaughter, of murder in self-defense, of coldness, of passion, of second-degree murder, none of that will be relevant. The question is whether the man brought before you is guilty of first-degree murder. And first-degree murder, ladies and gentlemen, implies a question of planned intent. It is a charge that suggests a state of mind in which the guilty party premeditates a murder in cold blood, that he thinks about it ahead of time and makes a conscious decision. And here, said the judge, is a difficult matter for jurors in cases of this sort. For premeditation is a condition of the mind and cannot be seen directly. Premeditation must be inferred from the evidence. It must be seen in the acts and words of the human beings who have testified before you, in their conduct and conversation, and in the evidence brought to your attention. In order to find the defendant guilty, you must find that he planned and intended to commit the acts for which he has been charged, that he premeditated murder. Understand that he went forth in search of his victim with the conscious intent of committing a premeditated murder, that it did not happen in the heat of the moment or as the accidental result of escalating violence, but was rather an act planned and executed by a man with murder on his mind. So once again, the court charges you to consider only first-degree murder and absolutely nothing else. You must be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt of one thing and one thing exclusively, that the defendant in this case is guilty of murder in the first degree, premeditated. You were selected as jurors in this case, Judge Lew Fielding continued, in the belief that each of you could, without fear, favor, prejudice, or sympathy, in sound judgment and clear conscience, render a just verdict on evidence presented in conformity with these instructions. The very object of our jury system is to secure a verdict by comparison of views and discussion among jurors, provided this can be done reasonably and in a way consistent with the conscientious convictions of each. Each juror should listen, with a disposition to be convinced, to the opinions and arguments of the other jurors. It is not intended under the law that a juror should go into the jury room with a fixed determination that the verdict shall represent his opinion of the case at that moment. Nor is it intended that he should close his ears to the discussions and arguments of his fellow jurors, who are assumed to be equally honest and intelligent. You must, in short, listen to one another. Stay objective. Be reasonable. The judge paused and let his words sink in. He let his eyes meet the eyes of each juror, holding the gaze momentarily of each. "Ladies and gentlemen," he sighed, "since these are criminal proceedings, understand your verdict, whether guilty or not so, must be a unanimous one. There is no call for haste, or for anyone to feel that they are holding up the rest of us as you deliberate. The court thanks you in advance for having served in this trial. The power has gone out, and you have passed difficult nights at the Amity Harbor Hotel. It has not been easy for you to concentrate on these proceedings while you're worried about the conditions of your homes and the welfare of your families and loved ones. The storm, said the judge, is beyond our control. But the outcome of this trial is not. The outcome of this trial is up to you now. You may adjourn and begin your deliberations." Chapter 30. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, The jurors in the trial of Kabuo Miyamoto filed out of the courtroom. Two of the reporters tipped their chairs back precariously and sat with their hands clasped behind their heads, speaking casually to one another. Abel Martinson handcuffed the accused man, then allowed his wife to speak to him once before urging his prisoner toward the basement. "You're going to be free," she said to Kabuo. "They'll do the right thing, you'll see." "I don't know," her husband replied. "But either way, I love you, Hatsue. Tell the kids I love them, too." Nels Goodmanson gathered his papers together and slid them into his briefcase. Ed Soames, in a generous mood, kept the courtroom open to the public. He understood that the citizens in the gallery had no warm place to go. Many of them sat languidly along the benches or milled in the aisles discussing the trial in hushed and speculative tones. Ed stood with his hands behind his back, beside the door to Judge Fielding's chambers, in the obsequious pose of a royal footman, watching everything impassively. Occasionally he checked his watch. In the gallery, Ishmael Chambers mulled over his notes, looking up every now and again to take in Hatsue Miyamoto. Listening to her testify that morning, he'd been keenly aware of his private knowledge of this woman. He'd understood what each expression suggested, what each pause signified. What he wanted, he realized now, was to drink in the smell of her and to feel her hair in his hands. It was all the more acute for not having her and wanting, like the wish he had to be whole again and to live a different life. Philip Milholland's notes were in Ishmael's front left pants pocket, and it was just a matter of standing up, crossing over to Ed Soames, and asking to see Judge Fielding. Then bringing the notes out and unfolding them, and watching the look on Soames's face, then taking them back from Soames again and pushing his way into the judge's chambers. Then Lou Fielding, blinking down through his glasses, pulling the candelabra on his desk a little closer, the flickering taper dancing left and right, and at last the judge peering over his glasses at him as the weight of Philip Milholland's notes began to press against his mind. The freighter began its dog leg at 1:42. Karl Heine's pocket watch stopped at 1:47. It spoke for itself. What was it Nels Goodmanson had said in closing? "The counsel for the state has proceeded on the assumption that you will be open, ladies and gentlemen, to an argument based on prejudice. He is counting on you to act on passions best left to a war of 10 years ago." But 10 years was not really such a long time at all. And how was he to leave his passion behind when it went on living its own independent life, as tangible as the phantom limb he'd refused for so long to have denervated? As with the limb, so with Hatsue. Hatsue had been taken from his life by history, because history was whimsical and immune to private yearnings. And then there was his mother, with her faith in a god who stood at the wayside indifferently while Eric Bledsoe bled to death in the surf. And then there was that boy on the deck of the hospital ship with the blood soaking his groin. He looked at Hatsue again, where she stood in the midst of a small group of Japanese islanders who whispered softly to one another and peered at their watches and waited. He examined her knife-pleated skirt, the blouse she wore with long darts through the shoulders, her hair bound tightly to the back of her head, the plain hat held in her hand. The hand itself, loose and graceful. And the way her ankles fit into her shoes, and the straightness of her back, and her refined, true posture that had been the thing to move him in the beginning, back when he was just a child. And the taste of salt on her lips, that time when for a second he had touched them with his own boy's lips, clinging to his glass-bottomed box. And then all the times he had touched her body and the fragrance of all that cedar. He got up to leave. And as he did so, the courtroom lights flickered on. A mute kind of cheer went up from the gallery, an embarrassed, cautious island cheer. One of the reporters raised his fists into the air. Ed Soames nodded and smiled. The gray, sullen hue that had hung over everything was replaced by a light that seemed brilliant by comparison to what had gone before.
"Electricity," Nels Goodmanson said to Ishmael. "Never knew I'd miss it so much."
Go home and get some sleep, answered Ishmael. Turn your heater up. Nels snapped the clasps on his briefcase, turned it upright, and set it on the table.
By the way, he said suddenly, I ever tell you how much I liked your father? Arthur was one admirable man.
Yes, said Ishmael, he was. Nels pulled at the skin of his throat, then took his briefcase in his hand.
Well,
he said, with his good eye on Ishmael, the other wandering crazily,
regards to your mother, she's a wonderful woman. Let's pray for the right verdict in the meantime.
Yes, said Ishmael. Okay. Ed Soames announced that the courtroom would remain open until such time as a verdict was reached, or until 6 p.m., whichever came first. At 6, he would let the gathered court know about the current status of things. In the cloakroom, Ishmael found himself beside his sow Imada as they both struggled into their overcoats.
Many thanks for giving to us a help, Isao greeted him. It make our day much better than walking. We have our many thanks to you.
They went out into the hallway, where Hatsue waited against the wall, her hands deep in her coat pockets. Do you need a ride? Asked Ishmael. I'm going out your way again, to my mother's house. I can take you.
No, said Isao. Thank you much. We have made for us a ride.
Ishmael stood there buttoning his coat with the fingers of his one hand. He buttoned three buttons, starting at the top, and then he slipped his hand into his pants pocket and let it rest against Philip Milholland's notes.
My husband's trial is unfair, said Hatsue. You ought to put that in your father's newspaper, Ishmael, right across the front page. You should use his newspaper to tell the truth, you know. Let the whole island see it isn't right. It's just because we're Japanese.
It isn't my father's newspaper, answered Ishmael. It's mine, Hatsue. I run it. He brought his hand out, and with some awkwardness, slipped another button into place. I'll be at my mother's, he told her. If you want to come speak to me about this there, that's where you can find me. Outside, he found that the snow had stopped. Only a few scattered flakes fell. A hard winter sunlight seeped through the clouds, and the north wind blew cold and fast. It seemed colder now than it had been that morning. The air burned in his nostrils. The wind and the snow had scoured everything clean. There was a sound of snow crunching under Ishmael's feet, the whine of the wind, and nothing else. The eye of the storm, he knew, had passed. The worst of it was behind them. And yet, there was still a blind chaos to the world. Cars turned front first to the curbs, abandoned where they had skidded unpredictably. On Harbor Street, a white fir fallen against the snow, its branches snapped off at splintering angles, some of them piercing the ground. He walked on and found two cedars across the road, and beyond that, the town docks were mostly swamped and underwater. The outermost pilings had broken loose. The wind had shoved against the outside piers, and two dozen boats had piled up against one another, and finally up onto the sunken piers, where they listed against their mooring ropes. The white fir's root wad had pulled out of the ground and stood now like a wall more than 20 feet high, with a tuft of snow-laden ferns and ivy sprouting over the top of it. White caps roiled among the capsized boats, and caused them and the docks to surge and roll, and the tops of the cabins and drum reels and gunwales were loaded down with snow. Occasionally, sea foam broke across the boats, and water washed through their cockpits. The tide and the wind were pushing in hard now, and the current funneled through the mouth of the harbor. The green boughs and branches of the fallen trees lay scattered across the clean snow. It occurred to Ishmael for the first time in his life that such destruction could be beautiful. The reckless water, the frenzied wind, the snow, the downed trees, the boats dashed against their sunken docks. It was harsh and beautiful and disorderly. He was reminded for a moment of Tarawa Atoll and its seawall
and the palms that lay in rows on their side, knocked down by the compression from the naval guns. It was something he remembered too often. He felt inside not only an aversion to it, but an attraction to it as well. He did not want to remember, and he wanted to remember. It was not something he could explain. He stood there looking at the destruction of the harbor, and knew he had something inviolable that other men had no inkling of, and at the same time, he had nothing. For 12 years, he knew, he had waited. He had waited without knowing he was waiting at all, and the waiting had turned into something deeper. He'd been waiting for 12 long years. The truth now lay in Ishmael's own pocket, and he did not know what to do with it. He did not know how to conduct himself, and the recklessness he felt about everything was as foreign to him as the sea foam breaking over the snowy boats and over the pilings of the Amity Harbor docks, now swamped and underwater. There was no answer in any of it, not in the boats lying on their sides, not in the white fur defeated by the snow, or in the downed branches of the cedars. What he felt was the chilly recklessness that had come to waylay his heart. It was a boat builder who lived out on Woodhouse Cove Road, a gray-bearded man named Alexander Van Ness, who was primarily responsible for holding up a verdict in the trial of Kabuo Miyamoto. For 3 hours, until 6 o'clock, he persisted in the same inexorable vein that Judge Fielding's admonitions should be heeded with the utmost seriousness and that reasonable doubt existed. The 12 jurors had argued over the meaning of the word doubt, then over the meaning of the term reasonable, then over both put together. "Well," Alexander Van Ness had concluded, "I guess it comes down to a feeling, doesn't it? If I feel uncertain, if I feel that I doubt, that's all that matters, right?" It had seemed to the others that he would not budge, and they had prepared themselves by 5:45 for another long night at the Amity Harbor Hotel and for the necessity of taking the matter up with Alexander Van Ness at 8 o'clock the next morning. "Now look here," Harold Jensen argued desperately, "nobody ain't ever sure about nothing. It's unreasonable to be so dog-headed stubborn. What's reasonable comes out of the rest of us, right here. You're what's unreasonable, Alex." "I can see what you're driving at," Roger Porter added. "I know what you're trying to say, Alex, and I've thought that way about it myself. But look here and think about the straight-off evidence. That mooring line come off his boat. That blood was on his fishing gaff. Mostly, he lied about replacing his battery, things like that. It was fishy. He just didn't show me nothing."
"Me neither," put in Edith Twardzik. "Didn't show me a thing either. It was just suspicious how he sat there like that and said one thing about it to the sheriff one time and then later changed his melody. A person can't go changing his tune without the rest of us thinking on it, Mr. Van Ness. Don't you believe that man's a liar?"
Alex Van Ness agreed amiably. The defendant had indeed lied. But that made him a liar, not a murderer. He wasn't accused of lying.
"Now look again," said Harold Jensen. "What do you figure drives a man to lie? You think a man's got to go and lie when he ain't done nothing worth lying about? A lie's a cover-up every time. It's something a man says when he don't want the truth out. The lies that man's been telling about this, they tell us he's got to be hiding something. Don't you agree with that?"
"All right," answered Alexander Van Ness. "Then the question is, what's he hiding? Is he necessarily hiding the fact he's a murderer? Does that follow for sure and nothing else? I'm telling you, I have my doubts, and that's all I'm trying to tell you. Not that you're wrong, just that I have my doubts."
"Now listen to this," snapped Edith Twardzik. "Supposing a man's got his gun to your son's head and another one at your wife. He tells you to take yourself exactly 1 minute and decide whether he ought to shoot your son or your wife. Which should he shoot? And if you don't decide, he'll shoot them both. Of course you're going to have some doubts no matter which way you decide. There's always something to fret about. But meanwhile, while you're fretting, the man's getting ready to pull both triggers, and that's all there is to it, all right? You aren't ever going to get past your doubts, so you have to face it head on."
"It's a good example," answered Alex Van Ness, "but I'm not really in that situation."
"Well, try looking at it another way, then," said Burke Latham, a schooner deckhand. "A big old comet or a chunk of the moon could come crashing down through the roof just now and fall on top of your head. So maybe you'd better move yourself, case such a thing might happen. Maybe you'd better have your doubts about whether your chair is safe. You can doubt everything, Mr. Van Ness. Your doubt ain't reasonable." "It'd be unreasonable for me to move to another chair," Alex Van Ness pointed out. "I'd run the same risk anywhere in the room, same risk you run from your seat, Burke. It's not worth worrying about." "We're not talking about the evidence anymore," Harlan McQueen told them. "All these hypothetical examples aren't getting us anywhere. How are we going to convince him what's reasonable without talking about the facts presented by the prosecutor step by step, each one? Now, look here, Mr. Van Ness. Don't you think that mooring line has to tell you something?"
"I think it does,"
said Alex Van Ness. "It tells me that Kabuo Miyamoto was probably on board Carl Heine's boat. I don't have much doubt about that." "That's one thing," noted Edith Twardzik. "That's something, anyway." "That fishing gaff," said Harlan McQueen, "it had a man's blood on it, Carl Heine's blood type. Can that slip past your doubt?"
"I don't much doubt it was Carl's blood," Alex Van Ness agreed. "But chances are it came from his hand. I think there's a chance of that."
"There's a chance of everything, but you add a chance from here and a chance from there. Too many things get to being a chance. They can't all be that way. The world ain't made of coincidences only. If it looks like a dog and walks like a dog," Burke Latham asserted, "then most probably it is a dog. That's all there's going to be to it."
"Are we talking about dogs now?" asked Alex Van Ness.
"How did we get on to dogs?"
"Well, what about this?" said Harlan McQueen. "The defendant heard about Carl's body being found, but did he go to the sheriff and tell him how the night before he'd seen Carl out fishing? Even after they arrested him, he just kept saying he didn't even know a single thing about it. Then later, he changed his story, came up with this battery explanation. Then he even altered that, said he'd put in a spare battery, but only on cross-examination. At this point, it's his story against the prosecution's, and I'm finding him a little hard to believe."
"I don't believe anything about him either," Ruth Parkinson said angrily. "Let's get this done and over with, Mr. Van Ness. Stop being so unreasonable."
Alex Van Ness rubbed his chin and sighed.
"It's not that I can't be convinced," he said. "I'm not so stubborn I can't be made to see the light. There's 11 of you and one of me. I'm all ears, and I'll listen to anything, but I won't be in such a hurry as to go in there while I still have what I think are reasonable doubts and condemn the defendant to the hangman's rope or 50 years in prison. You ought to sit back and relax, Mrs. Parkinson. We can't hurry this."
"Been here almost 3 hours," said Burke Latham. "You saying there's a way to move slower?"
"The mooring line and the fishing gaff," Harlan McQueen repeated. "Are you with us on those things, Mr. Van Ness? Can we push forward from there?"
"The mooring line, okay, I'll give you that. The fishing gaff's a maybe, but assume I'll go with you. Where do you take me from there?"
"The different stories he told. Prosecutor really cornered him on having two batteries on board. If he'd really loaned one to Carl Heine, there should have only been one."
"He said he replaced it. He explained that well enough.
He added it in at the last minute," cut in McQueen. "Made it up only when he was cornered, didn't he? He had his story pretty well lined up, but he left that detail out."
"True," said Alexander Van Ness. "There should have only been one battery, but let's suppose he did board Carl's boat. Maybe it was to talk about the land business. Maybe Carl attacked him. Maybe it was self-defense or manslaughter, an argument that got out of hand. How do we know this was murder in the first degree, planned out ahead of time? All right, it could be the defendant's guilty of something, but maybe not what he's charged with. How do we know he boarded Carl's boat with the intention of killing him?"
"You heard what all them fishermen said," Roger Porter answered. "No one ever boards a boat at sea except in an emergency. He wouldn't have come aboard just to talk, you see. Fishermen don't do things that way."
"If they only board in an emergency," said Alex, "then the battery story makes good sense to me. A dead battery, that's an emergency. It kind of shores up his story."
"Oh, come on," said Edith Twardzik. "Harlan's right about the battery story. Miyamoto didn't any time loan one to Carl Heine. Otherwise, he'd only had one himself. That battery story just won't wash."
"It was a sucker's ruse," Burke Latham explained. "Just like the prosecutor said, Miyamoto pretended he was dead in the water, drifted right down on top of Carl, and took advantage of him. That's exactly what happened."
"Wouldn't put it past him," said Roger Porter. "The man looks damn sly to me."
"That sucker's ruse story," said Alex Van Ness. "To me, that's just a stretch too far. Drifting down out of the fog like that and exactly into the very man you've got it in your mind to kill. Here it is, the middle of the night, fog as thick as pea soup, thicker, and you're expecting you'll just neatly drift in and find the boat you're looking for? That, to me, is a stretch."
At 6 o'clock, Ed Soames made the announcement. The jurors had adjourned for the night. No verdict had been reached thus far. The courthouse was going to be closed, he added. Everybody should go on home and get a good night's rest, turn up their electric heaters. They could return at 9 o'clock in the morning if they wished to know where matters stood. The jurors ate dinner at the Amity Harbor Hotel and talked of other matters. Alexander Van Ness ate meticulously, wiping his hands on his napkin often and smiling at the others, saying nothing. Chapter 31. The power was not yet on along South Beach, and as Ishmael Chambers drove through the snow, he glanced into the candlelit windows of the homes he'd known since childhood. The Englands, Gunnar Torval, Verda Carmichael, Arnold Kruger, the Hansons, the Sivertsons, Bob Timmons, the Crows, Dale Papineau, Virginia Gatewood, and the Etheringtons from Seattle, who 7 years ago had moved to the island for good. He supposed they regretted it now. Footlong icicles hung from their eaves, and the snow lay in drifts against the north side of their house. They should have gone on being summer people. The Crows had both passed away years before, and now their son Nicholas inhabited the place, steadfastly carrying on the border war with Bob Timmons, who had phlebitis in his legs these days and walked stiffly to clear the branches from where they fell among his cedar trees. Nothing had changed, and everything had changed. Dale Papineau still drank too much and had no money to speak of. Verda Carmichael was gone. Ishmael found his mother at her kitchen table once again, reading the last chapter of Sense and Sensibility by lantern light and drinking tea with sugar and lemon concentrate. She wore a coat and boots in the house, and her face looked bland and old with no mascara, for which she asked Ishmael's forgiveness. "I'm getting to be so old," she admitted. "There just isn't any way around it." Then, just as before, she gave him soup to eat, and he told her how the jurors had not reached a verdict, and how the lights were on once more in town, and how the docks had been destroyed by storm winds. His mother railed against the possibility that the jurors would be driven by hatred and prejudice. She hoped that in such an eventuality Ishmael would write an editorial. His newspaper, she said, had a responsibility at such times. His father before him had known that. Ishmael nodded and agreed with her. He would write a strong editorial. Then he suggested they pass the night at his apartment with its electric heat and hot water. His mother shook her head and claimed she was content to stick it out at South Beach. They could go to Amity Harbor in the morning if they wanted, so Ishmael loaded the cook stove with firewood and hung his coat in the hall closet. Philip Milholland's notes stayed in his pants pocket. At 8 o'clock the power came on again, and he flipped the furnace switch. He roamed through the house, turning off lights and turning up the baseboard heaters. The pipes, he knew, would begin to thaw now, and he decided to sit and listen to the house while it came back to itself. He made tea and took it into his father's old study, a room with a view of the water in daylight, and of his father's much-loved rhododendrons. And he sat in silence at his father's desk, in his father's chair, with a single light on. He waited while the furnace gradually warmed the house, and then Ishmael heard water moving in the pipes and the drip from the taps he'd left open. He waited a while longer before moving through the house again to see that the pressure was strong everywhere, and then he shut down the taps. Everything seemed to have held up. At 9 o'clock his mother kissed his cheek and said she was going to bed.
Ishmael returned to his tea in the study, where he pondered his father's books. His father had been, like his mother, a reader, though his idea of good literature differed from hers. He was far less given to novels, in the main, though he read his fair share of them, too. His books stood neatly along the glassed-in shelves of four vault-like oak bookcases. The collected Shakespeare, Jefferson's essays, Thoreau, Paine, Rousseau, Crèvecoeur, Locke, Emerson, Hawthorne, Melville, Twain, Dickens, Tolstoy, Henri Bergson, William James, Darwin, Buffon, Lyell, Charles Lamb, Sir Francis Bacon, Lord Chesterton, Swift, Pope, Defoe, Stevenson, St. Augustine, Aristotle, Virgil, Plutarch, Plato, Sophocles, Homer, Dryden, Coleridge, Shelley, Shaw. A history of Washington State, a history of the Olympic Peninsula, a history of Island County, gardens and gardening, scientific agriculture, the care and cultivation of fruit trees and ornamental shrubs. His father had loved his fruit trees. He'd tended quietly to his apples and rhododendrons, his china berries and mulberry hedges, his rows of vegetables and flowers. He could be found on fall afternoons with a rake in hand or a splitting maul, perhaps. One year he'd painted the eaves and dormers, the clapboards and the deep-shaded summer porch, taking his time, finding pleasure. He never hurried. He did not appear to wish for something else. There were his evenings reading and dozing by the fire, or working slowly at his desk. In his study lay two large Karistan rugs, woven in a mountain village in Turkey, the gift of a soldier he'd fought beside at Belleau Wood long ago. Each had knotted, carefully combed tassels, fleur-de-lis borders, ornate medallion designs, and minute scalloping amid a motif of connected eight-spoked wheels, all in rust and fire orange. The desk, too, was pleasing. His father had built it himself. It was a vast expanse of cherry wood, the size of an English baron's dining table. Smoked glass covered most of its surface. Ishmael recollected his father at work here, his neatly arranged manila folders spread out before him, his yellow legal pad laid off to his right, an array of heavily scrawled index cards, onion-skin typing paper in both goldenrod and white, a thick dictionary on a stand, a thicker thesaurus, and a heavy black Underwood typewriter, the desk lamp pulled down low over the keys, and his father blinking through his bifocals, slow and expressionless, absorbed in his words. Afloat in that pool of soft light. He'd had a cordial, lonely, persevering face, and Ishmael turned now to stare into it, for there was a portrait of Arthur hung on the wall just to the left of a bookcase. There he sat in his high, stiff collar, no more than 20 or 21, a young logger on his day off from the woods. Ishmael knew his father had come to logging with a romantic sense of grandeur, viewing it at first as grandly heroic, in keeping with the spirit of manifest destiny. He'd come to outgrow this with the passing of time, and then he passed his evenings reading. Sleep had seized him like a dark claw, while other boys drank their hearts out. He'd educated himself in his spare time, had saved his money with the earnestness of a Horatio Alger, started his own newspaper, gone to war, come home, pressed on, moved forward. He'd built his own house, hauling riverstone, milling lumber, a man prominently and wondrously strong far into his 40s. He did not mind writing garden club features, school board reports, horse show notices, golden anniversary announcements. He pruned them as carefully as he pruned his hedges, rounding them toward perfection. He'd been at best an anguished editorialist. He was incapable of fully indulging himself when it came to condemnation, for he'd recognized limits and the grayness of the world, which is what endeared him to island life, limited as it was by surrounding waters, which imposed upon islanders certain duties and conditions foreign to mainlanders. An enemy on an island is an enemy forever, he'd been fond of reminding his son. There was no blending into an anonymous background, no neighboring society to shift toward. Islanders were required, by the very nature of their landscape, to watch their step moment by moment. No one trod easily upon the emotions of another where the sea licked everywhere against an endless shoreline. And this was excellent and poor at the same time. Excellent because it meant most people took care, poor because it meant an inbreeding of the spirit, too much held in, regret and silent brooding. A world whose inhabitants walked in trepidation, in fear of opening up. Considered and considerate, formal at every turn, they were shut out and shut off from the deep interplay of their minds. They could not speak freely because they were cornered. Everywhere they turned, there was water and more water, a limitless expanse of it in which to drown. They held their breath and walked with care, and this made them who they were inside, constricted and small, good neighbors. Arthur confessed to not liking them, and at the same time loving them deeply. Was such a thing even possible? He hoped for the best from his fellow islanders, he claimed, and trusted God to guide their hearts, though he knew them to be vulnerable to hate. Ishmael understood, sitting in his father's place, how he'd arrived at the same view of things. He was, it occurred to him, his father's son. And now he brooded in the same spindle-back Windsor chair his father had brooded in. Ishmael remembered following his father one afternoon as he roamed the grounds of the strawberry festival in search of photographs and winning quotes. By 3 o'clock the sun had swung down over the west goalposts of the high school football field. The tug-of-war, sack-hop, and three-legged races were over, and a languidness had inevitably crept over things, so that here and there grown men slept in the grass with newspapers over their faces. Many of the picnickers had eaten to excess, and now sat heavy and dulled in the sun, which poured over the scene a clear, clean radiance, a piercing island summer light. The odor of baked salmon hung stale in the air, slightly bitter and slightly acrid from the long smoldering smoke of burning alder leaves, and lay like an invisible pall over the exhausted revelers. Ishmael walked beside his father, past the concession booths where shortcake, bagged popcorn, and caramel apples were sold, and down toward the displays of strawberries. And then his father stopped to bring his camera to his eye and photograph the fruit that was the point of it all. And at the same time, peering through his lens, he held up his end of a conversation. "Mr. Fukuda," he'd called out, "a banner year for strawberries. How are prices holding up?" Mr. Fukuda, a leathery old farmer in overalls and a billed cap, answered in English that was too precise, too perfect. "Prices are very good," he said. "In fact, excellent. Berries selling very well. Mrs. Chambers just now purchased 16 crates.
"I see," said Arthur. 16 crates. No doubt I'll be asked to help with them, then. Can I trouble you, Mr. Fukuda, to move a little to your left? This should make an excellent photograph, you and your beautifully displayed strawberries."
Mr. Fukuda, Ishmael recalled, seemed to have no eyes. His lids had sealed themselves nearly together. Occasionally a thin tear trailed out. Working its way along the cracks in his face, it would eventually end as a shine against his cheekbones, which were prominent high points in an otherwise gaunt set of features. He smelled of ginger and onion root tonic, and, when he smiled, teeth large as old beach stones, of powdered garlic, too.
"Mrs. Chambers will put up some excellent jam," Arthur had said without pride.
He shook his head now, admiring with genuine avidity the spread of fruit before him, strawberries arranged in turned-up cedar flats, heavy and pungent, deeply crimson and firm, a regal abundance of them.
"Fit for a queen," Arthur had said. "My hat is off to you. Good soil, good rain, sunshine, 6 children. "There must be a secret you're not mentioning. I've tried growing strawberries myself a few times, and with most of the same ingredients."
"More children," said Mr. Fukuda, and grinned so that his gold crowns glinted in the sun.
"More children, yes, that is the secret. That is important, Mr. Chambers." "Well, we've tried," said Arthur. "We've tried hard, Lord knows, but Ishmael here, my boy Ishmael here, he's a match easily for 2 lads, for 3. We have high hopes for him."
"Oh, yes," Mr. Fukuda had said. "We wish good fortune for him, too.
We believe his heart is strong, like his father's. Your son is very good boy.
Ishmael went up the worn-out stairs to the room he'd slept in for so many years and dug the book on boatmanship out of its box in a closet. There was the envelope with Kenny Yamashita's return address, the upside-down stamp, her smooth handwriting. There was the letter written on rice paper, fast fading after all these years, as brittle as old leaves in winter. With his one hand it would be possible in seconds to squeeze Hatsue's letter into motes of dust and obliterate its message forever. I don't love you, Ishmael. When we met that last time in the cedar tree, and I felt your body move against mine, I knew with certainty that everything was wrong. I knew we could never be right together. He read the letter a second time, gravitating now toward its final words. I wish you the very best, Ishmael. Your heart is large, and you are gentle and kind, and I know you will do great things in this world. But now I must say goodbye to you. I am going to move on with my life as best I can, and I hope you will too. But the war, his arm, the course of things, it had all made his heart much smaller. He had not moved on at all. He had not done anything great in the world, but had instead reported on road paving projects, garden club meetings, school athletes. He had coasted along for years now, filling the pages of his newspaper with words, burying himself in whatever was safe. Typesetting the ferry schedule and the tide table and the classified advertisements. So perhaps that was what her eyes meant now on those rare occasions when she looked at him. He'd shrunk so thoroughly in her estimation, not lived up to who he was. He read her letter another time and understood that she had once admired him. There was something in him she was grateful for, even if she could not love him. That was a part of himself he'd lost over the years. That was the part that was gone. He put the letter away in its box and went down the stairs again. His mother, he found, was asleep in her bed, snoring a little, a rough rattling in her throat. She looked very old in the light from the hallway with her cheek buried against her pillow, a sleeping cap pulled low on her forehead. Her face was a map of wrinkles, and looking at them he felt more deeply how he would miss her when she was gone. It did not matter whether he agreed with her about God. It was only, instead, that she was finally his mother, and she had not given up on loving him. His trips to South Beach, he understood now, were as much for his own heart as they were for hers. He had fooled himself for years into thinking otherwise. He had acted as if her death someday, for someday he would have to face the fact that her death would leave him alone in the world, would not pose a problem for him. Beneath the stars, with his overcoat on, he wandered out into the cold. His feet took their own direction through the cedar woods, and underneath the canopy of branches he smelled the old fragrance of the place of his youth, and the clean scent of the newly fallen snow. Here, under the trees, it was fresh and untouched. The branches of the cedars were hung with it, and beyond them the sky lay immaculate and decembral, the stars chilled points of light. He followed his feet to where the path met the beach, where a wall of honeysuckle bloomed in summer, intertwined with salmon berries and wild roses, and cut through the dell of snow-covered ferns to the hollow cedar tree of his youth. Ishmael sat inside for a brief time, with his coat wrapped tightly around him. He listened to the world turned silent by the snow. There was absolutely nothing to hear. The silence of the world roared steadily in his ears while he came to recognize that he did not belong here. He had no place in the tree any longer.
some much younger people should find this tree, hold to it tightly as their deepest secret, as he and Hatsue had. For them, it might stave off what he could not help but see with clarity, that the world was silent and cold and bare, and that in this lay its terrible beauty. He got up and walked and came out of the woods and into the Yamada's fields. The way was clear between the rows of buried strawberries, and he followed it, with the starlight striking off the snow, bathing everything in an aqueous light. And finally, he was on the Yamada's porch, and then in the Yamada's living room, sitting with Hatsue and her mother and father, where he had never been before. Hatsue sat beside him, just beside him, close, wearing a nightgown and her father's old bathrobe, her hair awash in light along her back, falling in cascades around her hips. And he reached into his pocket and unfolded the notes Philip Milholland had written on September 16th. And Ishmael explained what the shorthand meant, and why he had come at 10:30 in the night to speak to her after all these years. Chapter 32. There was no way to call Lou Fielding with the news because the phones were all dead along South Beach. So the four of them, cups of green tea in hand, the barrel stove murmuring and clicking in its corner, spoke quietly about the trial of Kabuo Miyamoto, which was for them the only subject possible, as it had been for many days. It was late now, the room very warm, the world outside frozen and bathed in starlight. And Ishmael told Hatsue and Hisao and Fujiko that as a reporter who had covered the courthouse in Seattle, he felt comfortable offering a present conjecture. That Philip Milholland's notes would force Judge Fielding to call for retrying the case. That the judge would declare a mistrial. Hatsue recalled that in the course of his testimony, the sheriff had described finding a coffee cup tipped on its side, the sheriff had explained, on the floor of Carl Heine's cabin. It meant, she said, that Carl's gillnetting boat had been rocked by a freighter in the middle of the night. Something had knocked that coffee cup down. And since Carl had never picked it up, it had to be that the very same something had knocked him down as well. It had to be, she repeated. Her husband's case should be thrown out. Spilled coffee didn't really prove very much, Fujiko urged her daughter to see. Hisao shook his head in agreement. There had to be more than spilled coffee, he said. Kabuo was facing something very large. He would need more than a coffee cup tipped onto its side to get him out of jail. Fujiko refilled Ishmael's teacup carefully and asked how his mother was faring. She said she had always thought highly of his family. She complimented Ishmael on the quality of his newspaper. She brought a plate of butter cookies and pleaded with him to eat one. Finally, Hatsue's baby began to whimper. They could hear him plainly from one of the back rooms, and Fujiko disappeared. Just after midnight, Ishmael took his leave, shaking hands with Hisao, and thanking him for the tea and asking him to thank Fujiko, too. Then he went out. Hatsue followed him onto the porch, wearing rubber boots and her father's old bathrobe, her hands deep in her pockets now, the fog of her breath streaming out of her mouth and billowing over her nose and cheeks. Ishmael, she said, I'm grateful. Look, he replied, when you're old and thinking back on things, I hope you'll remember me just a little. Yes, said Hatsue. I will. She moved closer then, and with her hands still buried deep in her pockets, kissed him so softly it was like a whisper against his cheekbone. Find someone to marry, she said to him. Have children, Ishmael. Live. In the morning his mother roused him at 6:50, saying that the wife of the accused man was here, waiting for him in the kitchen. Ishmael got up and splashed cold water against his face and put on his clothes and brushed his teeth. When he came down, his mother was standing by the cook stove, and Hatsue was at the table sipping coffee, and when he saw her, he remembered once again how softly she had kissed him the night before. "Do you want me to leave?" his mother asked from her place in front of the wood stove. "I'll leave, of course, so you can talk." "We'll go in the study," answered Ishmael. "Why don't we try the study, Mrs. Miyamoto? Why don't we go in there?" "Take your coffee," his mother suggested. "I'll top it off for you first." They made their way to the study, Ishmael leading. The first light of morning, a wintry orange hue dappling the sky, appeared high and far in the distance above the salt water, faint beyond the leaded windows. The rhododendrons were all loaded down with snow. Icicles hung from the eaves. Everything looked seized by a white stillness. Hatsue had woven her hair into a long braid, glistening, dark, and thick. She wore a thick-ribbed woolen sweater, a pair of navy dungarees, and a pair of calf-high fisherman's boots. And she stood now looking at the portrait of Arthur from long ago in his logging days. "You look just like him," she said to Ishmael. "I always thought you looked like your father, the eyes especially." "You didn't walk over here in the dark and snow just to tell me that," answered Ishmael. "What do you have on your mind?"
"I thought about it all night," said Hatsue. "Do you remember when my husband testified? He said that Carl had a lantern up, a kerosene lantern lashed to his mast, that he'd put it there because his lights weren't working. He'd lashed a handheld kerosene lantern high up on his mast."
Hatsue rubbed her hands together, then separated them again lightly.
"My idea," she said to Ishmael, "is that if that lantern's still up there right now, wouldn't it mean his batteries really were dead? Supposing you looked up Carl's mast and saw a kerosene lantern lashed up there, just like Kabuo said, wouldn't that tell you something? That his lights were out and he'd lashed up a lantern as a sort of emergency measure, don't you think that would prove something?"
Ishmael sat down on the edge of his father's desk, scratched his chin, and thought about it. Art Moran's report, the way he recalled it, hadn't said a word about a kerosene lantern lashed up high in Carl's mast, but, on the other hand, Art could have missed it. Such a thing was possible. At any rate, it was worth finding out.
"All right," said Ishmael. "Let's go into town. Let's go in and have a look."
They took the DeSoto over snow-dazzled roads, decorated with cracked and fallen branches, and with the green twigs of cedars and hemlocks. The storm had passed, and on the west side of Lundgren Road, five children stood at the crest of the hill, with sleds and inner tubes at their feet, looking down at the runout below. A bowl surrounded by slender alder trees, and a thicket of low, bare vine maple. Ishmael turned west on Indian Knob Hill Road, and they passed the Masui's strawberry fields, and then the Thorsons' milk cow barn, and Patsy Larson's chicken houses. Hatsue sat with her mittens in her lap and her hands held close to the car heater.
"We ought to go to see my husband first," she said. "We ought to tell him what's going on. I want to show him the Coast Guard notes."
"The jury reconvenes at 8, answered Ishmael. "If we can get a look at Carl's boat first, we can go to the courthouse with everything. We can put a stop to the whole business. We can end it all," he said. She was silent for a long time, watching him. She looked at him closely and pulled her braid down over her shoulder so that it lay against the front of her sweater.
"You knew about that freighter," she said finally. "It wasn't something new, was it?" "A day," answered Ishmael. "I sat on it for a day. I didn't know what I should do."
She said nothing in the face of this, and he turned toward her silence to see what it might mean.
"I'm sorry," he said. "It's inexcusable."
"I understand it," answered Hatsue. She nodded and rubbed her hands together, then looked out at the sun-dappled snow.
"Everything looks so pure," she said. It's so beautiful today.
Yes, it is, agreed Ishmael. At the sheriff's office in Amity Harbor, they found Art Moran hunched down at his desk beside an electric heater. When Art saw the two of them come through the door, he dropped his pen at the edge of his desk blotter and stood and covered his eyes with his hands.
"Wait a minute, let me guess," he said. "You people are on a mission."
Hatsue brought out the Coast Guard notes, and, smoothing them down with the palm of her hand, laid them in the center of his desk. "Mr. Chambers discovered these," she said. "He brought these to me last night."
"And?"
"A freighter out there," said Ishmael. "The night Carl Heine died, a freighter came through Ship Channel Bank, just like—"
"You playing detective?" Art said. "You trying to be Sherlock Holmes? We got the mooring rope and that fishing gaff with Carl's blood on it. Those things speak for themselves, don't they? What else does a body need?"
"Look, Art," Ishmael answered, "I suggest that if you're capable of reading shorthand, you take a look at those notes there. I think they ought to make you consider at least going down to take another look at Carl's boat, okay? See if there's anything that's been missed, Art, in light of what's on your desk there." Art nodded. He nodded at Hatsue, too, for just a moment, and then he sat down beside the electric heater again and took the Coast Guard notes between his fingers.
"I can read shorthand," he said.
He was in the middle of reading the notes to himself, Ishmael and Hatsue watching him, when Abel Martinson came through the door in a pair of knee-high loggers caulk boots and a military-issue polar parka, its fur-lined hood pulled tight around his head, his nose and chin a deep red.
"The phones are up," he announced to the sheriff. "They just got 'em up about half the island. Town's got phones, and south from there all the way out to the lighthouse." "Listen," replied the sheriff. "Listen here, Abel. We're going down to Beeson's cannery dock to Summonson's warehouse, okay? You, me, Ishmael here, the lady'll wait at the cafe or something, get herself a breakfast. Can you get yourself a breakfast or something? Because you're a little too close to all of this. You're a little too close to this already. I don't like the smell of it, okay?"
"It's me," said Ishmael. "It isn't her. This comes from me all the way."
"Just the same," said Art Moran. "Go get yourself some eggs, Mrs. Miyamoto. Read the papers, maybe."
Abel blew his warm breath against the lock before opening Summonson's warehouse, a mildewed barn built of creosoted timbers put up more than 50 years earlier. Even in the snowstorm it smelled of salt and tar, and more faintly of diesel fuel and rotting lumber. Its sea doors opened onto the harbor so that boats could motor in and then out again once repairs were made. Its tin roof kept island rains out. With its two hoists, scaffolding, and wide-elbowed piers, it was a good place to overhaul a boat in winter. For the past 2.5 months, the sheriff's department had rented it from Arv Summonson for the purpose of sequestering the Susan Marie and the Islander in berths side by side. It had been padlocked and on occasion patrolled by Abel Martinson, who kept the key in his pocket. Nothing, he insisted, had been tampered with. The boats had sat in the warehouse untouched since the 17th of September. Abel opened the sea doors wide, and a gray light flooded in. Ishmael looked immediately at the Susan Marie's mast, and then all along her cross spar. No lantern hung anywhere. They went into Carl Heine's cabin. Ishmael stood in the doorway looking out while the sheriff ran a flashlight across everything, the cased sausage beside the binnacle, the short bunk, the ship's wheel, the battery well. "You know," said Ishmael, "when you were testifying, Art, you mentioned a coffee cup on the floor here, remember? Where was that exactly, the coffee cup? Do you remember exactly where it was?"
"I picked it up," said Abel Martinson. "It was right there in the middle of the floor."
"Everything else was neat and clean?
Just the cup, that's all?"
"Like you see it," said Abel. "We didn't change anything, just a cup. I picked it up, a habit, I guess. Something's on the floor, a mess, I pick it up, can't help myself."
"Next time, help yourself," said Art Moran. "You're making a sheriff's investigation, don't change anything at all."
"Okay," answered Abel, "I won't." "The cup," said Ishmael, "a cup on the floor. Doesn't it suggest this boat got waked, don't you?"
"There's no other evidence," cut in Art Moran. "A guy gets waked hard enough to go overboard, you'd expect maybe more than a coffee cup on the floor. Everything's so neat and clean."
They went out and stood just to port of the cabin door while Ishmael maneuvered a flashlight beam up and down the mast.
"You remember that business about the lantern?" said Ishmael. "How Carl hung a lantern up there? Did you guys take that down?"
"Hold your flashlight still," answered Abel. "Just above the cross spar, there."
He shone his own flashlight upward then, so that two beams shone against the mast now. There were cut lashings of net twine visible there, loose ends dangling, 10 or 20 figure eights cut through cleanly on an angle.
"That's where his lantern was hung," said Ishmael. "He'd hung a lantern up there, lashed it up because all his lights were dead. That's where Carl hung his lantern."
"We never took no lantern down," said Art. "What are you talking about?"
Abel Martinson hoisted himself on top of the cabin, propped one foot against the cowling, and shone his flashlight upward one more time.
"Mr. Chambers is right," he said. "Listen," said the sheriff, "climb up there, Abel. Haul yourself up there and take a closer look, and don't touch anything."
"I need to push off your hands," said the deputy, shoving his flashlight in his pocket. "Give me a boost and I'll go up." The sheriff gave Abel Martinson a boost, and he lunged in his polar coat toward the crossbar. He wrapped one arm over it and hung there, the boat rocking, while his other hand fished for the flashlight.
"Looks like a rust streak crossed these lashings," he said. "Like it could be off the handle of a lantern, maybe. Where the handle rubbed against them, maybe."
"Anything else?" said the sheriff.
"You can see where the lashings been cut," observed Abel. "Somebody took a knife to 'em. And, hey, something else. This stuff on the mast? It looks like it might be blood."
"From his hand," said Ishmael. "He cut his hand. It was in the coroner's report."
"There's blood on the mast and the spar pole," said Abel. "Not much, but I think it's blood."
"He cut his hand," repeated Ishmael. "He cut his hand, making room for Kabuo's battery. Then he got his power back up. Then he climbed up there to take his lantern down because he didn't need it anymore." The deputy slid down and landed hard.
"What's with all this?" he said.
"Something else," said Ishmael. "You remember Horace's testimony? He said Carl had a shuttle of twine in one pocket and an empty knife sheath knotted to his belt. You remember Horace saying so, Sheriff, how the knife sheath was empty, unbuckled? A shuttle of twine and an empty knife sheath.
He climbed up to take his lantern down," said Abel. "That freighter came along and knocked him from the mast. The knife and the lantern went overboard with him. The knife and the lantern were never found, right? And pipe down a minute, Abel," said Art Moran. "I can hardly hear myself think."
"He hit his head on something," said Abel. "The freighter wake hit, the boat rolled over, and then he fell and hit his head on something and slid on out of the boat." 10 minutes later, in the port side gunwale just below the mast, they found a small fracture in the wood. 3 small hairs were embedded in the crack, and Art Moran carved them free with his pocket knife and tucked them into the sheath in his wallet that also held his driver's license. They looked at the hairs in a flashlight beam, and then they all fell silent.
"We'll take these up to Horace," decided Art. "If they end up to be from Carl Heine's head, the judge will have to take things from there."
At 10 o'clock, Judge Fielding sat down with Alvin Hooks and Nels Goodmanson. At 10:45, the jurors were told that they were released from any further duties. The charges against the accused man had been dismissed. New evidence had come to light. The accused man himself was set free immediately and walked out of his cell without leg irons or handcuffs. Standing just outside its door, he kissed his wife for a long time. Ishmael Chambers took a photograph of this. He watched their kiss through his viewfinder. Then he went back to his office, turned up the heat, and loaded paper in his typewriter. And he sat staring at it for some time. Ishmael Chambers tried to imagine the truth of what had happened. He shut his eyes and exerted himself to see everything clearly. The Susan Marie had gone dead in the water. The bolt shook loose in her alternator pulley bracket on the night of September 15th. In a drowning fog, impatiently drifting, and too proud to just lay hard on the air horn he carried in anticipation of times such as these, Carl Heine must have cursed his misfortune. Then
He lit his two railroad lanterns, slipped his twine shuttle into his back pocket, and hauled himself up to the cross spar on the mast. A lantern slung temporarily down his back, his rubber bib overalls slipping. The cotton twine he used for mending net bound the lantern to the mast easily, but Carl put in extra lashings anyway. Figure eights, laid one over the other, pulled taut and finished crisply. He hung for a moment, his armpit against the spar, and knew that his light was futile against the fog. Nevertheless, he adjusted the flame higher before clambering down. And he stood in the cockpit listening, perhaps, with the fog closed in around him. And perhaps after a while he took his other kerosene lantern and picked out the 5/8 wrench from his toolbox to tighten the alternator pulley belts, cursing again just under his breath. How was it possible he'd neglected this? Failed to check it as a matter of course? Come to such a pass as his present one, which ordinary seamanship might have prevented? And he, a man who prided himself silently on the depth and purity of his seamanship. He tightened the belts, pressed his thumb against them, then went out once again and stood leaning against the port gunwale. Karl Heine listened to the fog and to the sea, to the other boats moving off the bank with their whistles sounding incessantly, and to the water softly lapping against his boat as he drifted with the tide moving east. He stood with one foot up, the kerosene lantern handy, the air horn clutched in his hand. Something in him would not use the horn, and for a good long time, an hour or more, he debated whether he should use it anyway, and he wondered if there were fish in his net. It was then that he heard a boat not far off, the sound of a foghorn blown deliberately, and he turned his ear in its direction. Six times it came, nearer at each blast, and with his watch he timed the precision of its intervals. 1 minute went by between each. When it drew inside of 100 yards, he gave a single blast on his air horn. The Islander, her hold full of fish, and the Susan Marie, dark and dead on the water, a kerosene lantern lashed to her mast, her skipper poised in her bow with his chin set, came together in the fog. Then Kabuo's mooring lines were made fast to deck cleats in the efficiently wrought half-hitches Karl Heine could lay out with no thought or hesitation. A battery changed hands. It was somewhat too large. A metal flange was beaten back. Carl's hand was sliced down the palm. There was blood on Kabuo's fishing gaff. An agreement was arrived at eventually. The things that needed to be said were said between them, and Kabuo pushed off into the night. Maybe it had seemed to Kabuo Miyamoto, alone on the sea shortly afterward, a fortuitous thing to have come across Karl Heine in circumstances such as these. Perhaps it had seemed just the sort of luck he'd long thought he needed. His dream, after all, was close to him now. So close that while he fished, he must have imagined it. His strawberry land. The fragrance of fruit, the fold of the fields, the early summer ripening, his children, Hatsue, his happiness. Oldest son of the Miyamotos, great-grandson of a samurai, and the first of his lineage to become an American in name, place, and heart. He had not given up on being who he was. He had never given up on his family's land or the claim they had to it by all that was right, the human claim that was bigger than hate or war or any smallness or enmity. And all the while he was thinking this way, celebrating this sudden good fortune in his life and imagining the fragrance of ripening strawberries, he was drifting in the darkness, drifting in fog, with the low moan from the lighthouse barely audible and the steam whistle blasts from the SS Corona growing louder and coming closer with each moment. And a half mile to the south and west of the Islander, Karl Heine stood in his cabin door and listened uncertainly to the same whistle blasts now penetrating through the fog. He had made black coffee and held his cup in one hand. The kettle had been stowed in its place. His net was out and running true behind as far as he could tell. All of his lights were burning strong now. His voltmeter showed 13.5 volts charging, and the Susan Marie ran hard and steady, her spotlight suffused in the fog. It was 20 minutes before 2 o'clock in the morning. Enough time left to catch plenty of fish. The coffee would keep him awake long enough to fill his hold with salmon. Surely Carl had listened to his radio. The lighthouse radio man dispensing advice, the freighter's navigator calling in positions, taking readings off Lanhedron Island, then suddenly deciding on a bisecting dogleg right through Ship Channel Bank. Carl had tried listening into the fog, but the thrum of his own engines masked all other sound, and he had to shut down and drift. He stood again, listening and waiting. At last there came another steam whistle blast, closer this time, definitely drawing closer, and he slammed his coffee cup to the table. He went outside then and considered getting hard-waked, the big swell from the freighter going right through him. And it seemed to him he was secure to take it. There was nothing to get bounced around very much. Everything was in its place. Except the lantern lashed to the mast. A big freighter wake would smash it to pieces. Carl would have seen it that way. And so he paid for his fastidious nature, his compulsion to keep things perfect. He paid because he had inherited from his mother a certain tightness through the purse strings. Drifting on the water, the corona bearing down on him in the fog-bound night, he figured he needed less than 30 seconds to haul himself up his mast, save a lantern that way. What were the risks? Does a man ever believe in his own imminent death, or in the possibility of accident? And so because he was who he was, his mother's son, tidy by nature, survivor of the sinking of the USS Canton and thus immune to a fishing boat accident, he climbed his mast with confidence. He climbed it, and in so doing opened the palm wound he'd incurred banging against the battery well's metal flange with Kabuo Miyamoto's fishing gaff. Now he hung by his armpit from the cross spar, bleeding and listening into the fog, working his knife from its sheath. Again there came the blast of the freighter's whistle, the low hum of its engines audible to port, so close he twitched in surprise at it, and then, with his blade, he exerted pressure through the figure-eight lashings he'd made a few hours earlier. Carl came away with the lantern's handle between his fingers and went to lock back his knife. It must have been that in the ghost fog that night he never saw the wall of water the corona threw at him. The sea rose up from behind the fog and welled underneath the Susan Marie so that the coffee cup on the cabin table fell to the floor, and the angle of deflection high up the mast was enough to jar loose the astonished man who hung there, not grasping the nature of what was happening. And still he did not foresee his death. His bloody hand lost its grip on the mast. The rubber of his overalls ceased to grip. His arms flew out and his fingers opened, casting the lantern and the knife into the water. And Carl Heine fell, swift and hard, against the Susan Marie's port gunwale. His head cracked open above the left ear, and then he slid heavily beneath the waves, water seeping into his wristwatch, stopping it at 1:47. The Susan Marie rocked a full 5 minutes, and while gradually she settled once again, the body of her skipper settled, too, into his salmon net. He hung there in the phosphorescence of the sea, gathering light and undulating. And his boat moved now on the tidal current, brightly lit and silent in the fog. The wall of water moved on. It traveled a half mile speedily and then gathered beneath the islander so that Kabuo felt it too. It traveled with nothing more to interrupt it and broke against the shore of Lanhedron Island just before 2 o'clock in the morning. The whistle of the freighter and the lighthouse diaphone sounded again in the fog. Kabuo Miyamoto, his net set, his radio off, the fog as palpable as cotton around him, replaced the line he'd left on Carl's boat with a reserve he kept stowed in his galley. Perhaps he'd squatted for a moment, building a bowline into the Manila, and heard the steam whistle of the passing freighter sounding low across the water. It would have been as sorrowful a sound in that heavy fog as anyone could readily conjure or imagine. And as it grew louder, as the freighter drew closer, it would have sounded all the more forlorn. The freighter passed, to the north, still blowing, and Kabuo listened to it. Perhaps in that moment he remembered how his father had buried everything Japanese beneath the soil of his farm. Or perhaps he thought of Hatsue and of his children, and the strawberry farm he would one day pass to them. The steam whistle from the freighter faded eastward. It sounded at intervals with the fog whistle from the lighthouse, a higher note, more desolate. The fog closed it in, muffling it, and the freighter's note went deep enough so that it seemed otherworldly, not a steam whistle, but a cacophony of bass notes rising from the bottom of the sea. Finally it merged with the lighthouse signal, so that the two of them sounded at the same moment a clash of sound, discordant. There was a dissonance, faint, every 2 minutes across the water. And finally, even that disappeared. Kabuo Miyamoto came home to embrace his wife and to tell her how their lives had changed. The lighthouse dog watch drew to a close, and Philip Milholland stuffed his notes into a folder and threw himself into sleep. He and the radio man, Robert Miller, slept steadily into the afternoon. Then they awoke and left San Pedro Island, transferred to another station, and Art Moran made his arrest. Well, thought Ishmael, bending over his typewriter, his fingertips poised just above the keys. The palpitations of Kabuo Miyamoto's heart were unknowable, finally. And Hatsue's heart wasn't knowable either, nor was Carl Heine's. The heart of any other, because it had a will, would remain forever mysterious. Ishmael gave himself to the writing of it, and as he did so, he understood this, too, that accident ruled every corner of the universe, except the chambers of the human heart.
The End. You've been listening to Snow Falling on Cedars by David Guterson, narrated by George Guidel. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends White Man's Grave by Richard Dooling, also narrated by George Guidel, and Darkness at Noon by Arthur Kessler, narrated by Frank Muller. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order another recorded book or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the telephone number on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.